Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 721, A Mosque in Munich. This program is being recorded on August 8th of the year 2010. We're going to plunge right back into the discussion where we left off. We have been reading from a book that provides the title for the broadcast, a very important book, which I recommend very strongly to the listeners. It's not a long read, unlike, for example, the book Family of Secrets by Russ Baker. That's a long read. This is not. It's called A Mosque in Munich, subtitled Nazis, the CIA, and the Rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in the West. It's by Ian Johnson, a Wall Street Journal reporter. And although it's got some flaws in it, it's an extremely important book. And it also helps to illustrate, in particular, it helps to illustrate in a profound way the Nazi and Western intelligence antecedents to much of what has coalesced as the modern Islamist movement. There's more to the modern Islamist movement, obviously, than just Western intelligence and Nazi influence. But at the same time, in coming to understand that and coming to understand how fascism could morph and manifest itself in the Islamic world, this is a very, very, very good book to read in order to gain background on that. Now, one of the people we've been taking a look at in this program is a fellow named Gerhard von Mende. Von Mende was a Baltic German. He had worked for the Third Reich during World War II. Then he went to jump to German intelligence in the post-war period. He was actively recruited by CIA and other elements of Western intelligence. Going back to OSS, or other elements of American intelligence, I should say. He never went to work, at least nothing is on the record, of his having worked for U.S. intelligence. However, much of his Ostministerium desk from the Third Reich did jump to AMCOM-LIB and CIA and American intelligence, even keeping some of the same terminology that had been used for the Third Reich's Ostministerium. Von Mende himself, however, although certainly no shrinking violet, he was a participant in the conferences at Wannsee that set forth the liquidation of European Jewry, and indeed his post-war career is inextricably linked with people who were involved with various aspects of the Nazi exterminations. Von Mende himself was a German nationalist, and he sought control of his wartime Soviet ethnic assets, but as vehicles for restoring Germany's pre-war borders, or pre-1945 borders. In this regard, Gerhard von Mende worked with and shared the sentiments of a fellow named Theodor Oberlander. Now, Theodor Oberlander had been a Third Reich official, an original Third Reich operative, I should say. He was an original participant in the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923. He was an Einsatzgruppen leader, presided over the use of the creation and depredations of the Nightingale Group. That was an Einsatzgruppen that, among other things, liquidated the Jewish population of Lvov or Lemberg. It's a city that has been alternately in Poland and the Ukraine. And the people who you were used to staff, the Einsatzgruppen Nachtingale or Nightingale Group, were members of the OUNB of Stefan Bandera. Now, I would point out that even after his resignation as the West German Minister Expelled of refugees, or as the West German Minister of Refugees or Expellee, Theodor Oberlander continued to network with far-right and fascist elements, and we've looked at him in conjunction with something called the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture. That's an international reactionary group involving many doctrinaire fascist elements. It was put together by General Charles Willoughby, nee Wiedenbach. He was Douglas MacArthur's G2 intelligence chief during World War II. He also was a German-born doctrinaire fascist whose idol was Francisco Franco. And after World War II, Willoughby put together a number of networks, including the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, which united people like Willoughby with people like Hermann Abs, the former chairman of the Deutsche Bank, Hermann Punder, an Abwehr officer from Riga, and among others, Theodor Oberlander was also a member of the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture. Another person who was a member of that group was Nelson Bunker Hunt of the well-known reactionary Texas Hunt family. One of the things that I find interesting about these historical elements is that when, in 2004 when it came out. That actually, that might have been 2005. In any event, when it emerged that the bank, well, no, actually, this came out in 2005. When it emerged that a letter from a Treasury Secretary official named George O'Toole had become public, this was a letter to Swiss authorities about the bank Altaqua, in which Altaqua was noted to keep a line of an unlimited line of credit for Al Qaeda. The fellow who was administering the Al Qaeda account at Bank Altaqua was a guy named Ali bin Musalim, who was found dead in his Lausanne, Switzerland apartment a month later. What was interesting is that, as discussed in, among other programs, For the Record 513, Ali bin Musalim had been under indictment in the United States since the early 1980s for conspiring to corner the silver market, and that he was doing in conjunction with the Hunt family. So with people like Theodor Oberlander networking on the one hand with some of these Islamist elements, many of them former Soviet ethnic minorities, and on the other hand, networking with people like Nelson Bunker Hunt. And later, we see Nelson Bunker Hunt networking with people from Saudi Arabia in an attempt at cornering the silver market. I think it's interesting to look at some of the current connections in terms of their historical antecedents. And when one sees, certainly Nelson Bunker Hunt is about as far from Islamism as one could possibly imagine. And yet, we see Nelson Bunker Hunt's name in connection with the operations of some of these same elements. The point being that when we're looking at the Muslim Brotherhood or other Islamic fascist elements, they must be seen as part of the fascist international or international fascista, albeit an Islamic element of the Fascist International. We concluded side two by taking a look at Gerhard von Mende's work with Theodor Oberlander. We looked at Oberlander last week in an excerpt of AFA 14. In For the Record 556 as well, we took a look at Theodor Oberlander, his post-war fascist networking with people like Charles Willoughby and Nelson Bunker Hunt. And it's interesting to keep in mind that the fellow who was maintaining the Al-Qaeda account at Bank Altaqua was a former professional associate in the silver operations of Nelson Bunker Hunt, part of Willoughby's ICDCC. We're going to begin the text excerpts for side two by reading about yet another individual who worked as part of Gerhard von Mende's team working now for the Federal Republic of Germany. This was a fellow named Walter Schenk, last name S-C-H-E-N-K. Now, he was a graduate and alumnus of the Seekereitsdienst, although it's maintained here, it's stated here, that the Seekereitsdienst was the security service. Actually, the Seekereitsdienst was the SS intelligence service, and the various liquidations that the Third Reich performed were conducted under the auspices of the SD, and specifically Walter Schenk was in charge of the SD desk at Lemberg/Lvov. That was the city where the Nightingale Group conducted its liquidations under the direction of Theodor Oberlander, who later was networking with people like Nelson Bunker Hunt and Charles Willoughby in the ICDCC. Of Walter Schenk, his work for the Third Reich, his position at the epicenter of the Third Reich's atrocities on the Eastern Front, of Walter Schenk and von Mende's association, we read, "Rounding out von Mende's team for the Federal Republic was a German, Walter Schenk, who functioned as von Mende's deputy. Schenk had not worked in the Ostministerium with von Mende, but von Mende knew him from the war when he headed the Lemberg office of the Nazi Sicherheitsdienst, or security service, where one of his responsibilities was Desk 3B, which oversaw Poles, Ukrainians, and Jews. Lemberg, known between the wars by its Polish name Lvov and today by its Ukrainian name Lviv, was at the time in eastern Poland, meaning Schenk was at the epicenter of the Holocaust. Schenk had quit university to join the Nazis, making him even less employable than von Mende after the war. He put in long hours helping von Mende design his evolving organization." And as Ian Johnson notes, Walter Schenk's position as head of the Lemberg office of the Sicherheitsdienst placed him at the very center of the Third Reich's extermination programs on the Eastern Front. Now, another of the people with whom Gerhard von Mende worked was Haj Amin al-Husseini, the self-anointed Mufti of Jerusalem. Mufti, by the way, is a Muslim scholar. And the Grand Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini, not only held the rank of general in the Waffen-SS, recruited numerous Muslim formations to fight for the Third Reich and the Axis. He was also active in Asia on behalf of the Japanese. Haj Amin al-Husseini also was the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, worked directly with the Muslim Brotherhood and Hassan al-Banna. He also worked very closely with Gerhard von Mende. One of the people that Haj Amin al-Husseini also worked very closely with was a guy named Johann von Leers. We've looked at him extensively in the past. Johann von Leers was in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Goebbels' propaganda ministry during the Second World War. He later became one of the key operatives in the post-war Nazi propaganda machine and became part of the Nazi diaspora to Latin America at one point and then to Egypt. Ultimately, Omar Amin von Leers became his name. He also called himself Lahars at one point. But Johann von Leers converted to Islam, was appointed by Nasser to be head of the Institute for the Study of Zionism, where he continued to crank out Third Reich-style anti-Semitic propaganda, only this time for Nasser's government. And in turn, Omar Amin von Leers had as one of his proteges a guy named Ahmed Huber, who was one of the directors of the Bank al-Taqwa. That's the same Bank al-Taqwa that had an unlimited line of credit for al-Qaeda, that account being managed for al-Qaeda / al-Taqwa by the late Ali bin Musalim, who was an associate of, among others, Nelson Bunker Hunt and the Hunt milieu. And as we're going to see, Haj Amin al-Husseini not only worked with Gerhard von Mende, but he also worked with Omar Amin von Leers, later Amin Lahars. And as we're going to see here, Johann von Leers, a.k.a. Omar Amin Lahars, put together a Hamburg-based group of Muslim immigrants called the German Muslim League and was using it to foment anti-Semitism. Something that I think is worth contemplating and what I've called for so many years on this program, food for thought and grounds for further research, and that concerns possible links. Again, I say possible links between the Hamburg cell that ultimately manifested itself on September 11th and the networks that were being set up in Hamburg, Germany, by Amin Lahars, a.k.a. Johann von Leers, a.k.a. Omar Amin von Leers, top Third Reich anti-Semitic propagandist for Joseph Goebbels, later the mentor, along with Haj Amin al-Husseini, to Ahmed Huber. Turning again to A Mosque in Munich by Ian Johnson, we read, after the war, the French arrested Husseini as a war criminal. He was allowed to return to Palestine because the British worried that trying him as a criminal would inflame Muslim passions. By 1948, he was again leading opposition to Jewish immigration. Despite what he had seen in Nazi Germany, he had no sympathy for those arriving, even though tens of thousands had barely escaped the Holocaust. Husseini continued to associate with ex-Nazis, such as the propagandist Johann von Leers, who had moved to Cairo and changed his name to Amin Lahars. Von Mende's intelligence reports show that Lahars had contact with members of the German Muslim League, a Hamburg-based group of immigrants. One report stated that Lahars, quote, intends to the society to start an anti-Semitic movement in the Federal Republic itself. Ex-Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, finances the plans of Amin Lahars. His goal? Anti-Semitism. Unquote. So according to the report actually secured, developed by von Mende, the Grand Mufti himself was helping to fund the activities of Johann von Leers, a.k.a. Omar Amin Lahars. And again, one wonders what link there might be. I'm not saying necessarily there's any link at all. There may be none. We're talking about a long stretch of history. On the other hand, seeing how some of these elements have manifested over the decades, I don't think it's an unfair question to ask whether perhaps the German Muslim League that was working with Amin von Leers, nay, Johann von Leers, as well as Haj Amin al-Husseini, might have had some link or influence upon the development of the Hamburg cell in the September 11th attacks. another interesting thing to contemplate here, and that is the possible areas of overlap between Islamism and Pan-Turkism. Now, last week, in an excerpt in For the Record 720, in turn, excerpting AFA program number 14, we took a look at some of the history of the Pan-Turkist movement. Now, generally, the most virulent Pan-Turkist nationalist elements in post-World War II Turkey have tended to follow in the Atatürk secular tradition. Kemal Atatürk basically reformed Turkey in the wake of World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, keeping it a secular state. And the basis, the font, so to speak, of Atatürk-style political power in post-World War II Turkey has been the army itself. And although fiercely nationalistic in many respects, they have tended to avoid Islamism. The current government of Turkey actually is a mild Islamic, and perhaps mild is the wrong word. It is an Islamist government of sorts. And in fact, Erbakan, the founder of the party to which Mr. Erdogan belongs, was associated with the aforementioned Ahmed Huber and the Muslim Brotherhood and the milieu of the Bank al-Taqwa. One wonders to what extent we will be seeing Pan-Turkists dovetailing interests with Islamists in the future. With what effect? Who knows? But and I'll be speculating about this in the future. Bear in mind that in AFA 710, we took a look at a December 2009 conference that was held in Georgia. That was a jihadist conference, which, in the opinion of the author of the article we looked at, had ostensible U.S. support. One wonders whether perhaps the great game is resuming once again, and one wonders to what extent some of the populations, in particular Muslim populations of the Earth Island, will be used as proxy warriors, as elements to try to secure the independence of some of the fossil fuel-rich lands in that part of the world, either independence from Russia or perhaps independence from some of the smaller former Soviet Central Asian republics. Remains to be seen, but these are things to watch in the future. What's interesting to note is that many of the former Soviet ethnic Muslims who had fought for the Third Reich were able to successfully represent themselves as Uyghurs, as Muslim representatives, Muslim inhabitants of Xinjiang, China. And the Uyghurs and their independence movement and its championing by the UNPO is something we've looked at in the past. The Uyghurs are a Turkophone, a Turkic-speaking Muslim minority in China who've been agitating for independence with the support of, among other elements, the UNPO, the Dalai Lama, the Muslim Brotherhood, elements of Western intelligence. I would note that the UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, just seems to be championing peoples whose home turf, so to speak, happens to lie on natural resource-rich land, in particular, oil and natural gas-rich land. The UNPO has been championing the rights of the Lakota in the United States. The Lakota's claim territory sits right over the Bakken Field, a huge, huge field of oil shale and other fossil fuel-rich lands. And so, too, Xinjiang province is rich in oil and other mineral resources. So as one looks at the ostensible humanism of groups like the UNPO and the championing of the rights of various ethnic minorities, keep an eye on this one and just see how many of these ethnic groups just happen to have their home turf lying on an area rich in fossil fuels. Now, bearing in mind what we looked at last week, let's take a look at the Turkic inclinations of many of the ethnic Muslims who had come from the Soviet Union and who had fought with the Third Reich. Many of them were able to successfully represent themselves as Uyghurs, and that's how they were able to avoid deportation back to the former Soviet Union, where they almost certainly would have been executed. Turning to a mosque in Munich, for most of the war, Turkey had remained neutral and maintained normal diplomatic and academic exchanges with Germany. A Turkish student union had been formed to represent Turks studying in Germany during the war. Nationalistic and pan-Turkic in their thinking, the students hit upon a simple solution to save their fellow ethnic Turks: declare the soldiers Turkish and issue them student identity papers. The idea wasn't as far-fetched as it sounds. Most of the soldiers were in their late teens or early 20s. If they had the presence of mind to ditch their Wehrmacht or SS uniforms and papers before entering the DP camps, no proof existed of their nationality or profession. Their mother tongues were Turkic dialects. With a bit of Polish, they could pass as Turkish students. The Turkish Student Union had been based in Berlin, but when the bombing got too fierce, it moved to the medieval university town of Tübingen in southern Germany. That put the students in close range of the refugee camps, especially in the U.S. sector. Within months, they were issuing Turkish identity papers wholesale. To vary the story and thus throw suspicious officials off their trail, they also claimed that some of the young men were from Xinjiang, China, a western province with a large Turkic minority. That became Garip Sultan's new homeland. After the war ended, he was sent to a DP camp. There, the students gave him a new first name, Garip, in place of the Russified name he had previously used, Garif. "We became ethnic Turks," Sultan said. "They gave me an identity from Kashgar in Xinjiang, so that's why I survived." Many of the other ethnic groups who were Muslims from the former Soviet Union who had fought for the Germans also were able to pass themselves off as Turks and or Uyghurs in order to escape deportation to the former Soviet Union. One of the people who was very active on behalf of U.S. intelligence with the Soviet ethnic Muslims who were active in Germany is also an individual we looked at last week in connection with the Pan-Turkist movement and also the shooting of the Pope, and that is a guy named Ruzi Nazar, nay Nazarov, who was working for the Central Intelligence Agency attempting to discredit the former Soviet Union to participants in the Hajj pilgrimage. Every Muslim, by the way, is, I don't know if required, but strongly encouraged by their faith to make the Hajj, which is a pilgrimage to Mecca, at least once during their lifetime. And during the 1954 Hajj, the aforementioned Ruzi Nazar, whom we looked at in connection with the shooting of the Pope, and we also looked at him in 549. Nazar, by the way, was an ethnic Uzbek, and he had fought for the Third Reich, actually fought for the SS in World War II. He then jumped to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and was representing ABN at its WACL conference, ABN at the 1984 WACL conference in Dallas, Texas. Ruzi Nazar was working for the CIA, attempting to recruit people, religious Muslims, from some of the ethnic groups that were from the former Soviet Union, and he was working for CIA in the 1954 Hajj to Mecca. Turning to a mosque in Munich, for some pilgrims, the 1954 Hajj was a bit different. Armed with ripe tomatoes and strong lungs, two CIA-sponsored Muslims turned Mecca into the site of a Cold War showdown. Two eager young men, Ruzi Nazar and Hamid Rashid, had followed the now familiar path to the West. Born in the Soviet Union and captured by the Germans, they collaborated with the Nazis and finally were recruited by U.S. intelligence. Their target? Soviet Hajis, who they claimed were engaged in spreading propaganda. Sponsored by AMCOM-Lib, Nazar and Rashid flew to Jeddah, the Saudi Arabian city closest to Mecca. They claimed to be Turks, got seats on a bus carrying 21 Soviet pilgrims to Mecca, and began their work talking to the Soviet Muslims and trying to sow seeds of doubt about their homeland. When that didn't work, they tailed their prey in Mecca, heckling them. And that, again, Ruzi Nazar, whom we looked at considerable length in, we looked at him in AFA Program 21. We looked at him in AFA 14. And we looked at him again in FTR Program 549. He, by the way, is now a leader. Ruzi Nazar, at least at the time of the publication of this book, is 89 years old and a leader in the Uzbek expellé community or émigré community in the United States. In light of some of the unrest in Kazakhstan among ethnic Uzbeks and possible Muslim Brotherhood involvement in that, one can but wonder whether Ruzi Nazar is retired truly at the age of 89. What we're going to look at, we're again jumping over a nice chunk of the book, A Mosque in Munich. It is my hope to interview the author at some point in the not too distant future. In any event, even if that falls through, this is a very important book and should be read by the serious members of this audience. What we're going to look at for the duration of the program is something which is as incredible as it is scary, and that is it's basically Ian Johnson entitles a nice chunk of the last part of his book, 1950s Redux, and what he is seeing is that in the second part of this decade, U.S. intelligence is once again recruiting the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is not gone into. We didn't go into that in the first part of this program to any length. Again, the Muslim Brotherhood elements were recruited to gain control of the Soviet Muslim emigre community that was residing in Germany in order to use it in the Cold War. But as Ian Johnson points out during the concluding portion of his book, in an attempt at promoting moderation in the Muslim community, once again the CIA and the State Department are utilizing the Muslim Brotherhood. Concluding now, a State Department-sponsored conference on November 15th and 16th, 2005, called Muslim Communities Participating in Society, a Belgian-U.S. dialogue, brought together 65 Belgian Muslims and U.S. tutors from the Islamic Society of North America. The U.S. diplomats thought so highly of ISNA that it seems to have been appointed as a co-organizer of the conference. From an historical perspective, this was almost comical, a case of taking coal to Newcastle. ISNA, as seen in Chapter 14, was founded by people with extremely close ties to Nahda and the Muslim Brotherhood leadership in Europe. The State Department was importing Muslim Brotherhood Islamists with roots in Europe to tell European Muslims how to organize and integrate. Even more interesting, some of those European Muslims invited to the conference were themselves part of the current Muslim Brotherhood Network. And skipping down, in 2007, a similar project took place in Germany. The U.S. consulate in Munich actively backed the creation of an Islamic academy in the town of Penzberg. The group behind the academy had close ties to Milli Görüş, essentially a Turkish version of the Muslim Brotherhood, which regularly appears on lists of extremist organizations in Germany. And this same type of outreach by State Department and Muslim Brotherhood has continued under the Obama administration as well. Skipping down, this endorsement of the Brotherhood began to spread beyond the State Department. The Department of Homeland Security continued to oppose the Brotherhood and made any sort of affiliation with the organization grounds for refusing a person entry in the United States. Skipping ahead, by the second half of the decade, even the CIA, reflecting its mindset of the 1950s, was backing the Brotherhood. In 2006-2008, the CIA issued reports on the organization. The former was more detailed, laying out a blueprint for dealing with the group. And skipping down yet again, the Obama administration has continued this policy, State Department and CIA policy, of promoting the Muslim Brotherhood. The new Obama administration evinced similar support. Skipping down, in January 2009, for example, the State Department sponsored a visit of German Muslim leaders to one of the bastions of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States, the International Institute of Islamic Thought, the organization set up after the epical meeting in 1977 at Hamas home base near Lake Lugano. The German visitors were key government officials in charge of the integration or recruitment of minorities into the police. One of the briefers was Jamal Barzinji, who, as seen in Chapter 14, had worked for Nahda in the 1970s and later was one of the triumvirate who set up a number of key Brotherhood-inspired structures in the United States. Also, though not mentioned here, very close to Grover Norquist and Karl Rove. So as Ian Johnson has noted, basically, the same policies pursued by elements of U.S. intelligence and state in the 50s are being resurrected, and once again, the State Department and CIA are promoting Muslim Brotherhood. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 721, A Mosque in Munich. This is being recorded on August 8th of the year 2010. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.